This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU and 88.5 WMUB. I'm Mark Purcell. Tomorrow at CCM in the Corbett Auditorium, a special concert. CCM goes to the movies with acclaimed film composer and distinguished UC alumnus Randy Edelman. He'll be in town for the concert tomorrow, but right now he is on the phone from California with us to talk about his life and career. Good morning, Randy, and thanks
morning,
for being
Mark.
Here.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
I know that you came to CCM, what, back in the 1960s? And
late 60s, yeah.
And had quite a time in the city. You said you really were affected by your time at the College Conservatory of Music.
Yeah, but also because there were other things going on. The most interesting things that I did, I mean, basically at the school, I was just studying, you know, kind of traditional classical music. I was a piano major. But I started working at King Records, which was still there at the time, it was literally located in a garbage dump somewhere in the city. None of us had cars, and I used to do arrangements there for, you know, a lot of the artists on that label, because at that time there were no studios between, like, I'm going to say, Memphis and Chicago. This was the only recording studio, and kind of got experience doing other kinds of things and writing arrangements, and so that was kind of an interesting thing. So that by the time I got out of school, I had a lot of recordings and records that I had been a part of as far as being, you know, an arranger, and I had started writing songs. And so when I got out of school and went to New York, I had a bag of all this stuff, which I slept into the Brill Building and met a guy named Tony Orlando, who eventually became, you know, Tony Orlando, knock, knock, knock on the ceiling. You know, he kind of was intrigued, and but that's how, you know, I kind of got started like that. But I did that, and then there was also a couple of theaters in town that I started writing incidental music for and stuff like that. Now, so those things were as interesting or more interesting to me than just the straight kind of studying that I was doing at the conservatory. And it turns out they had real fruition later on, you know, and pretty quickly after I got out of school.
Well, you had talked about doing arrangements at King Records and doing work on Broadway, being a music arranger and the like. Where did the break into film and TV come?
Oh, that, well, you know, what I always say, Mark, is that I had no interest in film composing or really composing in general, but certainly no, I wasn't a, you know, person that was into film scores or anything. I mean, I went to the movies like everybody else, and I always say that what I am is I'm a musician, and everything that I did after I got out of school and went to New York and played in the pit on Broadway and started writing songs and arranging for people, it was when I went out on the road with people like Pat Clark and Dionne Warwick and my eventual wife, Jackie DeShannon, that I had time to kind of write songs. And at that time, in the mid-70s, it's like if you could carry a tune, you could get and write a decent song, you could get a record deal as a singer-songwriter, you know.
Maybe that's for the good old days, the good old days.
I'm exaggerating, but that, I kind of would listen to this stuff, you know, Elton John's early albums and James Taylor and these kinds of people, and of course what the Beatles were doing, everything. And I really, really liked it. You know, it wasn't just I was trying to do something that I wasn't cut out for. I always had great love for pop music. And so to answer your question, I came out to L.A. when my first album was released and to conduct in Las Vegas in some of the big rooms at that time for the people that I was working as a music arranger for. And when the record company did some publicity pictures out at the old MGM lot, they said, oh, come on by the scoring stage. And I saw Elmer Bernstein scoring, I don't know what it was.
Wow.
But it intrigued me. And what intrigued me about it wasn't so much the musical end of it. That, of course, did. And the huge orchestra and everything. It was the mathematics of it. It was how the hell do you match the music with the movie? At that time, it's not like we have now where it takes me a second to sync something up with my computer. Those were the old days of the click tracks and watching the picture, and you have these lines going by. So anyway, I got intrigued and did some studying in this area and did a few little TV movies and stuff long before I broke into this, because at that time what started happening with my albums and stuff is people started recording the songs. And early on, the first people that heard my first album, I never realized what a needle in the haystack it was a group at the time called the Carpenters. And they just fell in love with my songs and recorded them and took me out as their opening act. And I had never sung before anybody, you know, not even my mother. And suddenly I am opening, doing 45 minutes in front of 15, 20,000 people a night. At that time, they were playing, you know, field houses and stuff. They weren't even concert halls. So I kind of suddenly became a different animal. I became a recording artist and writing songs. And to make a long story short, for the next 12 or 14 years, that's what I did. I made my own albums, and people recorded the songs, and I recorded the songs, and I had a lot of success with my own records in England and in Europe. So my life turned into being something very different than musically than I thought. But to get back to your question, all the time I had studied and had done a few little films, and when I kind of got bored with the, you know, won't get into detail about people like Clive Davis, you know, and you have to write the 3-minute hook song. I kind of got bored with that and decided, you know what, I'm going to start branching into some other areas, which, by the way, is very hard to do when you're a, quote, solo recording artist, because it actually worked out well, because though my songs became hits for Manilow and Olivia Newton-John and the Carpenters and a lot of other people, I wasn't known here as an artist the way I was in England and Europe. So when I started scoring things and breaking into television and doing series and themes like MacGyver and all that stuff, I wasn't pigeonholed, because in this town, if you get pigeonholed in something, they'll never buy you as a serious, quote, film composer. So it all sort of worked out well. It's sort of all my experience in all areas, whether it was the traditional classical music as an arranger, conductor, as an orchestrator, and all this experience that I had in the recording studio, knowing how to do a track very quickly, making records, served me well when I finally broke. And my big break was working with a guy named Ivan Reitman, who did Ghostbusters, and I did Twins and Kindergarten Cop and Ghostbusters 2 for him. And that kind of was many years, you know, after I was doing lots of stuff. And then after that, I didn't have time to do anything except score films. It was a little strange, because I was doing these big comedies, and every time I would do a small comedy like The Mask with Jim Carrey or My Cousin Vinny, the pictures would become wildly successful. So, and the music I was writing for this stuff wasn't necessarily funny music. I could play you some stuff and you wouldn't know it's from a comedy, because all these comedies have action sequences and romantic interest sequences and stuff like that. So then my thing became, you know, doing stuff like Last of the Mohicans and Gettysburg and doing other kinds of films other than comedies, which are, by the way, the most challenging to do. And so what I'm saying is, all the experience I had in the studio from records and classical training and playing in pits and working as an arranger, by the time I made that transition, I kind of was able to use all that experience, because it was very helpful to me when you're scoring a film, and I won't even get into the pressure you're under and the time constraints and working with the politics of studios and stuff. It all served me well. So it wasn't that I suddenly got into film scoring. It was after many years, but there was that little kind of interest early on, and that experience of doing some of these small TV movies and things like that. But then I was basically involved in basically songwriting and doing my own albums, which is, of course, a completely different thing than scoring films. And once I started scoring films and people started saying, well, how come you don't write a song for the film? And I used to look at them and go, like, the director is not interested in me being a songwriter. I need to save his ass in 80 scenes, 80 cues in the movie, you know?
Yes.
And each scene has to be properly, you know, the mood has to be right, the pace has to be right, the style has to be right. And believe me, these guys do not want to know. So most of the people that I work with the directors, unless they were from England, like Jonathan Lynn and Alan Parker and people like that, had no idea that I had this background as a singer-songwriter.
We're talking to Randy Edelman, the singer-songwriter, arranger, film score, more than 50 credits to his credit, and he'll be in town for a performance of his music tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at the Corbett Auditorium at the College Conservatory of Music at UC. We've been talking about films, and you mentioned television, too, but you've also done some television themes. How is that different? I mean, the NFL football theme.
Well, that's completely... I'll tell you about that. First of all, I didn't do that much television, and you don't, like when you do a show like MacGyver, you write the theme and you also write the score to the pilot, and if it's picked up, you do the score. So it's not like you write the theme and somebody else does that. You kind of do both. If it runs for a while, then you kind of bail and let somebody else do the heavy legwork. The sports stuff, though, it was very interesting. A guy named Dick Ebersol, whose name you probably know, who's the head of NBC Sports,
yes,
started using my film music. And they called me, and I went to New York. I was scoring a film for Frank Oz called Indian in the Cupboard. And they went in, and I went up to NBC, and they said, we want to show you something. And they showed me the America's Breeders' Cup. They showed me the World Series. They showed me the tennis. They showed me all this stuff, all segments with Randy Edelman's scores in there that they had used. And he said, we love the sound of your music, and we've been using it. And he said, we want you to write. At that time, they had the NFL franchise. So I wrote specifically a theme for the NFL. But basically, the interest and everything came from my film scores, which I always try to do a soundtrack album. And that led to my doing ESPN, the Sports Century, and that also led to Ebersol, who has the Olympic, the whole Olympic franchise, using my stuff like nonstop in the Olympics. And eventually they bought something that I did that they had no idea was from a TV pilot called The Adventures of Briscoe County Jr., and it has become the theme of when the Olympics come on, it's there. So I have the Olympic theme, winter and summer, with this music. And he never realized it was from something else. My engineer and I just put it. They asked me, do you have something that's not from a film? So this wasn't from a film. And years later, they ended up finding out that it was from something else. It doesn't mean anything because nobody knew it from that. But now they only know it from the Olympic music. So that was kind of a nice... And that's a completely different area. Nobody bothers you. It's not like when you're working on a film and director comes over. I mean, basically, they just, you just write a theme and go and record it. And it became a sort of a side, a nice little side area to work in.
It must have been fun trying to, you talk about your songs, Weekend in New England, a big Barry Manilow hit. And, you're still cranking out songs because back in 2005, you... I think I read somewhere it was your biggest chart record ever with Nelly's My Place.
That was weird. Yeah, that was what happens is, again, a long story, which I won't get into, but I had done a record that Patti LaBelle, 25 years ago, had a big R&B regional hit record with this song. And all I can tell you is somebody took that track and used the track, and somehow it got to Nelly and wrote a song over my track. I knew nothing about it. The record came out. You'd think somebody would call me. The song was published by CBS, and so everything was properly done. But at that time in my life when I wrote that song, I didn't have my own publishing like I did years later. You were lucky to get a publishing contract, and this fell under that. So I got half the song, and about 80 people are credited with writing the other part, which is the other song, but I held on to that, and what happened was I didn't know anything about it until somebody called me, and it was like number 4 pop, number 1 rap, number, and it became eventually number 1 in every area. But it was just weird, and that's when I was just scoring film, so it was just out of the blue and something really nice that happened.
Well, out of all your career, all the songs, all the scores, all the classical pieces that you've done, what has been the most fun? What did you have the most fun on?
You know what? I got to tell you, Mark. I mean, it's really all been fun, and I'm usually always kind of inundated and emotionally and musically involved with whatever I'm doing at the moment. And I've been fortunate. There are so many different kinds of experiences and moments. I don't have one. You know, I don't have a score. I mean, I could mention one score, and then I could say, oh, no, you know, there's something else. And a lot of the stuff, by the way, that I've been fortunate that a lot of the movies have been huge commercial successes. It's also the ones that people don't readily know about. That I've written music for, a lot of times the more personal, kind of introspective ones and intimate movies that certainly aren't comedy related at all, that I kind of, in a way, am most proud of, because if you listen to the music, it's more unique and interesting and basically, I guess the word is original. And on some of these movies that you do that are Hollywood, quote, star-driven pictures that I've done so many of, whether it's with Jackie Chan on Shanghai Noon and Shanghai Nights, or Eddie Murphy, or any of these people, or Sandra Bullock on While You're Sleeping, they expect the music to be something, to sound like something. And when you have people's and the politics, it's so expensive to make a movie now and to get it made, even with these stars in it. When you're in a time crunch and you try to tell the producer of the studio, hey, I have a new approach, and they've already previewed the film all over the country and gotten, let's say, an 86, which is a good score, to have. They don't want to know about some new concept. they want you to get a romantic comedy, stick to writing, whatever it is. And it gets difficult to try to be original. So the composer, all composers, and if they didn't say this, they would really be lying to you, have to deal with that expectation and still trying to put your own stamp and originality on the music, but you're dealing with a lot of elements that are involved in that. And it's the films that don't get an 86. I like the films that preview at 58, and they're disasters. And what they tend to do is leave me a little more alone, because they don't know what works. And maybe I have a really good idea that one of these people with questionable, from the director to the producer to the studio execs, maybe they're not exactly their background. You'd be surprised what their background is, but it ain't in the arts. And I'll leave it at that. So sometimes it's better for me to work on something where the expectations of the film, as far as from a marketing standpoint of view, aren't as high as other ones, and it gives me a chance to kind of stretch musically. Whereas, like when I did the third installment of The Mummy, which part of the music which I'm going to do in the concert, it's just like everybody's expectations are of the first two mummies. And the first two mummies, well, first one Jerry Goldsmith did, second one Alan Silvestri did, and I did the third. We all recorded them at Abbey Road with the London Symphony. This Mummy, it was a completely different story, and it took place in China in the year, 300 A.D., whatever. And the people were, shocked, where's the Egyptian mummy? Well, guess what? They should have checked that out before they put up $200 million to make the movie. It's the Chinese mummy. So the music, it's got to have a little smack of, the Far Eastern or Asian. It's got to sound a little like that, because that's where we are. So when you get into those kind of creative, it sounds funny, but it's not funny to a studio, and suddenly everybody is looking around, and then they're looking at me you did something. Well, guess what? This is a different movie, although it's the third installment and it's got Brendan Fraser and some of the same people. It's a different story, and they are in China, and the backlog story takes place as this old Chinese emperor. which why it was called Tomb of the Dragon Emperor, The Mummy 3. So anyway, you get into like these situations and you kind of like think, I can't believe that this is happening, you know, that creatively those kinds of obvious things can happen, you know. And I'm kind of stuck in the middle because I have to make it work.
Ah, the bane of the composer's
right.
existence.
So, and you know what? You get done with it, and with all these films, you hope that they use what you wrote in the places you wrote them for. I have had pictures open. I'm talking, Mark, main titles that open with a different piece of music from my score. And you say, how is that possible? For a million reasons, like they started with some new footage they shot, and we scored it a month ago. You know, and they found a piece of my music that they love for that thing. And I don't see it, because I don't go to the final mix or anything. I never do that anymore. They like it, and it works there, and then you go to see the premiere, and you're suddenly the movie starts, and it's like, what the hell is that? You know, I mean, that's shocking, and it's why there's the famous story of Leonard Bernstein, who scored one film. His buddy Aaron Copland told him this was a great area. Aaron Copland in the 40s scored lots of movies, great ones like Grapes of Wrath and all this stuff. And Bernstein scored this picture on the waterfront, you know, great picture with Marlon Brando and all this stuff. And he scored it, and then they screwed around with his music. They cut it up. They put it at different places. And he said he freaked out. And that's the last, never wrote another score. They made movies of his musical, like West Side Story and things like that. But they just used his songs and someone else did the stuff and he had nothing to do with it. But his personality and a lot of people's personalities couldn't deal with that kind of, you know, you write something. If you write something, you want it just the way it is, then you can be a composer and write your pieces, but you can't score films because you have to be ready to, which is why I said, if you get done with the film and it's like you're a baby and you do your soundtrack, I always do my soundtrack CD, and that's the way it is meant to be. The way it is in the movie sometimes is different. So you hope that most of it is, like I said, you know, the way you wrote it and where it should be, and you move on. You learn how to just move on because that's just the way it is. They, you know, you're not in control of the final product. But it's still, there's no other area like that. You know, you're not waiting for a hit show on Broadway to see if it's going to run or a record to sell. These things come out quickly after you're done. Even though you're under pressure, they come out, you know, fairly quickly and like all over the world. Shortly after you're done recording, you're recording, whether it's here or London or New York, with the best musicians in the world, and it's there. It is, and then it's there for history. It's there for all time in theaters and on television, and so it's kind of a lasting thing. So when a lot of these guys give me problems, as long as I know that I've written things in a particular score that I like and I feel are of, you know, musical value, I always say in my head, hey, you know what? I don't know where this guy's going to be, you know, what his next project is, but this music's going to be here and this film's going to be shown forever. And then you move on to the next thing. And then after a while, you build up a, you know, kind of a wonderful catalog of this stuff. And it kind of exists in the fabric of the world.
Singer, songwriter, arranger, and film score Randy Edelman in town tomorrow for the CCM Goes to the Movies with Randy Edelman concert. It happens at 7 o'clock at Corbett Auditorium. A chance for you to enjoy a lot of Randy's music and get a chance to meet the man himself. For more information, you can visit our website, wvxu.org. Well, thanks again, Randy. Wonderful stories.
Thank you, Mark. It was great talking to you.